Veterans Agriculture, Senate Agriculture and Veterans Budget Committee will come to order. Different things going to take place today, but we're going to keep moving along. We can't do confirmations yet because they don't have a quorum. So we're going to jump into the second item, and that's the budget recap, reductions, vetoes, and unallotment. Dan Mueller is going to help us run through this.
Mr. Chair, is the microphone on? Is the microphone on?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be working off, there's a spreadsheet that's two pages, double side, that I'll be working off of. And then later on the agenda, we have different people from the department that can come and talk about, especially with the Department of Ag, that can come and talk about specifically some of the programs within the Department of Ag and some of the effects of the budget reductions have had on some of their programs and what maybe the future looks like for some of their programs. But I'll sort of give just a quick overview of the whole both general fund budget for this funding division and also what the funding looks like in some of the other funds for the agencies in this budget division. The first page of the handout is a general fund summary for all the agencies in this budget division. Again, we have the Department of Ag, the Animal Health Board, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, Military Affairs, and Veteran Affairs. The total current general fund budget for this, all these agencies together, for fiscal years 10 and 11, you'll see down on line 41, is $165.29 million. Now, that is after the budget reductions from last legislative session and the governor's unallotments. The governor's unallotments for this budget area are on the very far right column, and there were only unallotments within the Department of Ag equaling $985,000. Again, these were after the legislative changes that we made in the last session. The legislative budget reductions that we made in this area totaled $12.25 million. And again, this was about a 7% reduction of our general fund spending. Within the Department of Ag, there is a $6.82 million of budget reductions that we made in the general fund. Most of this came from a $3 million per year reduction in ethanol payments, which equals the $6 million reduction you see on line 4, and leaving about almost $12.2 million per year for ethanol payments in 10 and 11, but that number is expected to go back up to $15.2 million a year in the next biennium, unless other changes are made. And some of the new initiatives that we had last year, we put $1 million in livestock investment grants, and again, it looks like we'll be getting an update from the department on how that program is proceeding. The rest of the reductions within the Department of Ag were either very specific to programs or some other small across-the-board cuts to some of the divisions. And then if you go to a biennium-to-biennium comparison, sort of that second or the first change column, you'll see a pretty big drop in general fund spending between the previous biennium and the current biennium. Much of that is due to one-time general fund spending that we did in the previous biennium, mostly for clean water and the next generation grant program. Used a lot of one-time general fund dollars. So it looks like there's a $19.4 million drop in general fund spending from the previous biennium to the current biennium. Like I said, a lot of that is due to the one-time funding that we had in the previous biennium. We'll go down to the Animal Health Board. In the previous biennium, we spent about $13 million of general fund. Currently, we're on pace to do about $10.55 million. So that's a little bit of drop. In the previous biennium, there was some one-time money that we put into the bovine tuberculosis prevention part of the Animal Health Board's programs. The rest of the programs, you'll see over on legislative changes, we actually put a little bit of new money into that, but then we also gave the Animal Health Board a little bit of reduction of $758,000, so it nets out to be about a 3.3% reduction from their base that we did last year, and there was no further governor on allotments to Animal Health Board. The next agency is the AURI. Previous biennium, they had an appropriation of $6.2 million. Last session, we reduced that by $434,000, or about a 7% cut. They are now at $5.766 million. There is no governor on allotments for that agency. The next program you'll see is Department of Military Affairs. Again, this is just all general fund spending for these programs or agencies. Previous biennium, they had a total appropriation of about $43.9 million. Currently, they're on pace for about a $44.8 million of general fund spending. That includes, you'll see on line 28, just a little over $2 million of money that carry forward from the previous biennium to the current biennium. These are largely for enlistment incentive programs, tuition reimbursements and bonuses and things like that, that when we make appropriations for those programs, if they don't use them all, they get to carry them forward. You'll see on legislative changes, we did increase the enlistment incentives programs by $3 million last session, and there were no reductions and no governor on allotments for military affairs. Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, during conference committee, this funding area also included veteran homes, but now that we're back in the Senate jurisdiction, veteran homes are not counted on our funding. I have a line for them there, but you'll see it's all zeros. But I keep it there just in case in the future when we line up with the House again, because in the House their budget division also include veteran homes. Over here in the Senate, that's over in Senator Berglund's budget division. So there's zeros there just because I'm not tracking it right now in this funding area.
Well, Dan, That jurisdiction got moved out of our committee.
Mr. Chairman, it's...
Senator Berglund, is that where it went back to?
Yeah, it's never was officially moved here. It got moved over to our area just in the conference committee because just to help line up with the House. But during the Senate budget process, it's always been Senator Berglund's budget area. The funding of it has. The policy and, again, like we talked, we had some reports from them on Tuesday, the policy area concerning the homes, this committee still covers. But as far as funding the homes themselves, that is done by Senator Berglund's division. So, Mr. Chairman, again, to quickly recap Department of Veterans Affairs, their funding from biennium to biennium has remained largely unchanged. $31.6 million the previous biennium, and we're at $31.9 million. The biggest change we made last year, you'll see on line 34, is the savings we took on the GI Bill. We used to fund that with a direct appropriation of about $6 million per year, and most of that was always going unused. So we changed it last year to an open appropriation, meaning it's a pay-as-you-go method out with the Department of Finance. And so we were able to capture, you know, or save $9.1 million just by changing the way that we appropriate that program. It didn't reduce any of the services or any of the reimbursements. But this funding division was able to save $9.1 million by doing that. But the other side of that is, we won't be able to recapture those savings again into the future. That was sort of a one-time or a permanent way we changed funding that program, and we had a good savings on that last year, but since it's now an open appropriation, we'll not be able to find savings in that program again unless you change the way you want to reimburse it. Under Veterans Affairs, we did do some new funding, $1 million within service and administration, and another $500,000 in claims and outreach. And again, this whole funding area, there's about $12.25 million worth of legislative reductions, or about 7% of the general fund base for this area. And again, $985,000 of government unallotments on top of that. So that's sort of a little bit of a quick summary of the general fund picture, at least for this funding division.
Any questions? Thanks, Dan.
On the next page, it's just sort of a quick overview of how this budget division compares to the sort of the whole rest of the general fund budget for all the budget areas. I put this on there just to kind of put things in perspective. You'll see we have on line 15, there's a total general fund budget in fiscal year 10 and 11 of $31.287 million. And on line 6, you'll see our funding division is, again, $65.29 million, or we're about now down to about 0.5% of the total general fund budget. So just put things in perspective a little bit. And our and the deficit we're looking at that everyone knows about right now is about $1.2 billion. And again, if everything was done proportionally, our portion of that deficit would be about $6 million, 6.2 or something like that. But once you start taking things like K-12 education and other areas sort of off the available things that we can cut, the sort of proportion amount for this funding division will probably go up. So we don't have a number yet about the amount that this division will have to cut, but I think we can assume it'll at least be proportionally will be the bottom point of what we'll have, this funding division will have to cut. So, but that'll be worked out here in the next month or so, a month and a half. So again, that's just a sort of a snapshot of the total general fund budget for all the funding divisions and where this division compares to some of the other ones. Mr. Chairman and members, the last two pages are, again, just sort of a total funding by all funds for each agency. Now, this general fund and then all the other funds that each agency spends. And it's just sort of to show, I don't have legislative changes and everything on here, but it's just sort of to show how much money beyond the general fund each of these agencies are spending, both in the current biennium and the previous biennium. With the Department of Ag, the thing I wanted to point out here on lines 12 and 13, you'll see under the current biennium, the Department of Ag did receive some of the legacy funding from both the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Department of Ag is using $2 million of that to and help with the emerald ash borer tracking and everything. And then they also received close to $9 million of clean water funding. And if you look at all funds, the Department of Ag, I'm looking at line 17, in the previous biennium spent about $149.9 million. And then in the current biennium, they're up to $158.5 million. Again, some of that increase is due to the legacy funding and also about a $8 million increase in federal funds that the Department of Ag is using in the current biennium, going from $12.7 million up to $20.5 million. down to the Animal Health Board. Again, most of their funding comes from the general fund, but there's a little bit of federal funds that is used by the Animal Health Board, and special revenue fund is pretty much revenue that they collect in fees. But you also see the Animal Health Board is receiving about a $1.1 million increase in federal funds. Down to AURI, that's all general fund, and I covered that sort of in under the previous table. Again, there's a decrease in funding from biennium to biennium. Department of Military Affairs, pretty much the state's, the only state funds that go into this is mostly general fund. There's a little bit of special revenue fund, and that's probably just for some fee for service. Under federal funds, you'll see the Department of Military Affairs is getting an increase in federal funds, and they also receive some federal stimulus money of, in the current biennium, of about $5.8 million. On to the last page. Looking at Department of Veteran Affairs, again, the pretty much the state funds are all general fund dollars. A little bit of special revenue fund. Again, that's probably money it collects in fees. A little bit of gift fund money. And then there again, the Department of Veteran Affairs is receiving about almost close to $6.2 million in federal stimulus dollars. So you'll see their spending when you show all funds going from $35.1 million the previous biennium up to $40 million the current biennium. And then the last there at the bottom of the table is just a summary of all funds when we put all the agencies together. The $165.2 million in the current biennium is general fund, and then once you count all funds, including in the federal funds, we're up to about $423.9 million of spending in this budget area. So that's my recap. And again, the Department of Ag is going to be up here after I'm done talking to talk about some of their specific programs and their budget changes. But otherwise, I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
Any questions from the committee? Well, thanks, Dan. Thank you. Mr. Higgins,
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Gene Hugesson, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. With me is Stephen Ernest, our financial division head and budget director for the department, and someone that those of you that have been around in the Senate for a while will remember he at one time used to work here until I took him away. So sorry about that. Your loss was my gain. What I'd like to do, and Mr. Mueller has done kind of an overview, as you have heard, in terms of some of the background. I'd like to, with your permission, get a bit more specific in terms of some of the things having to do with the Department of Agriculture. And what hopefully in your packet you'll have a chart that talks about the general fund budget history that shows a couple different bar graphs for about five fiscal years in the department's spending. And I just would walk you through that quickly as a bit of a background to bring you up to where we are currently. The reason I do that is that I think it's somewhat interesting if you look at what sort of the history has been of our general fund operating money for the department, that starting with the 02-03 and then a drop in the 04-05, it looks like in 06-07 we actually increased our general operation money, but for those of you that are aware and remember that we went through a time where we moved into a new building, and that building has significantly higher rent costs, and so there was about a $4 million infusion of funds for that that rent increase that took place at that time as well. As Mr. Mueller touched on, too, is when we went to 06 and 07 in the green bar there, increases again. But in that time, we had livestock grants, some clean water money, and then there was an addition, a laboratory supplement that was included there also. The magenta line that you see on top of the green lines would be the money that was passed through money that was appropriated to the department other than ethanol. The larger magenta line to the right in each of those cases would be the ethanol funding that was appropriated each of those 5 years also. And I do this just as sort of a background history to where we are bringing us up to date. With that in mind, members, I'd call your attention to the chart that has the yellow across the bottom that will show sort of where we are at the current time, and I'll walk you through that to illustrate what is going on here. The reason that some of the highlight is in yellow would be, again, pass-through grants from the department. The money above that would be the operational money, which I'll explain as we get into it.
Ours is actually green.
I'm sorry you didn't get color, but it's budget savings. What's highlighted at the bottom would be the equivalent of the what in mine is yellow. The column over to the left where it says base levels, this would be the amount that we looked at prior to starting last year's legislative session. And in the next column, the conference committee showing 2010-2011 would show what emerged out of the conference committee at that time. This would have been last year. And as was pointed out, Mr. Mueller mentioned it too, but if you flip it over to the back side, you'll notice that it was an 8.4%. Your figures might be a little bit different. I think it was 8.6, but it depends on what we're using here for comparison numbers. But a decrease in that funding. The following that, of course, there were some vetoes and the unallotment. And I suppose this is where I would spend a little time to just take you through what certainly did occur with that. If you would, at the same time you're looking at that, there is another handout that was included in your packet that talks about, it's a fact sheet that talks about the budget unallotment for fiscal year 2010. This would be the amount of money that the governor gave direction to the department in terms of what we were charged with in terms of coming up with the four allotment cuts. This did not include any pass-through grant money. This was only operational money that was included in the unallotments. And as was referenced in the State of the State today as well, don't have that one? Sorry about that. I'll go through it then in more detail so you can see what that might actually include then. I'll say that we get that to you as well, so that lists out the things that I'll list through. If you go through on that column where it says vetoes and unallotments, 2010-2011, the $27,000 reduction in pesticide fertilizer management, this is a reduction in agricultural line testing and some of the water monitoring activities that goes along. This is some activities that the department has been involved with, oftentimes working with some of the cities that get involved with land applying some of their lime to some ag land that they have to get rid of. The moving down to the next section, and members, if you have any questions along this as you go along, just please interrupt. But under the plant and pest area, we're talking a decrease there of $63,000. This was a reduction in some seasonal staff that were involved with such things as the firewood inspections, exotic pest surveys, and some of the gypsy moth trapping that we've done. Also having to do some reduction in the field samples for potato pests and less frequent inspections for fruits and vegetables. We looked at this very carefully because we're very cognizant of not wanting to jeopardize any food safety kinds of activities. And so as a result, felt we could do this without causing any significant harm in that area. The going down to the dairy and food inspection division, $138,000 per year reduction there, was we left one dairy and food inspection vacancy unfilled. eliminated some of the labeling inspections that we have previously been doing for the RGBH issue that goes on with labeling in grocery stores for milk. And what we did is, rather than going out and taking samples or looking at that, we moved to a situation that if people had complaints, obviously we'd follow up on the complaints. But it was not a case of going out and specifically looking for this in the grocery stores. Moving to the next area, a $50,000 reduction in marketing services was a result of two vacancies that were not filled, and being able to combine some responsibilities with some other staff movement also. The next area having to do with the Ag Development Financial Assistance Division, a $77,000 reduction there was, again, one vacancy that was not filled. It obviously created some situation where we had to change some activities to assign to other people, but it is still moving ahead in that direction. The other cut that was made was in the area of administrative activities. That includes such things as commissioner's office, IT, and what we did there was again eliminate some programs that we've been looking at in terms of trying to do some online licensing applications. We really have not cut back on any of that, but this was some money that was going to be used to enhance that, and so as a result, we cut that money in that area as well. And that brings us to the situation, as was mentioned earlier, the reason that we went to the to this area was obviously to bring us into compliance with the budget situation that we faced. The next column then would show just where those changes would take place. I would just point out that there were some internal changes that took place that, as it related to moving some responsibilities from one division to another division, it was actually a financial neutral decision or outcome there, but it just shows up there in that column also. Going to the current budget, that leaves us to where we end up then after vetoes and on allotments. And, of course, I think you're familiar with the governor's directive following the outcome of the November forecast, in which he instructed all the agencies to look at our remaining general fund money as well as our pass-through grant money. And the instructions that we were given there, and this shows then, I should point out, the remaining budget December 09, that was the cash that we had left in the accounts as of the middle of December of 09. And so what we did then, this was the amount that we were charged to work with in terms of where we were to arrive at the suggested 3% cut for the general fund operating amount and a 6% cut for the pass-through grants. And the reason, as the governor explained, he took that action at that point was that to not take that action, of course, would leave us with, by the end of the legislative session, with not something in place to slow down our spending situation. It was not a case of saying that this money would never be spent, but it was a case of holding that money in abeyance, so to speak, until the legislature had a chance to come and talk about where we want to go or what we do with that situation. So the column on the far right then would show where we are if, in fact, we were to do a 3% across-the-board cut and how much would come out of each of those divisions in the clear area. And then in the highlighted area would show the 6% cut that would occur as it relates to the pass-through grants. I would point out, for instance, that when you look at such grants as fairs, and this goes to the county fairs, obviously we had expended one half of the biennial budget or the 1 year's amount to the county fairs after July 1st of this last year, so that leaves half of the budget that's still there, that's unspent. So following that example, then that $28,000 off to the right would show what that would amount to if, in fact, we were to stay at that 6% cut level. I think you heard the governor mention this morning in the State of the State that his budget will be released next week. And at that time, you will see where the specifics come in. Now, I would caution you to not expect to see a 3% or a 6% necessarily across the board cut. But that was the amounts that we were charged with looking at. And I think so, especially as it relates to some of the general fund operating, you will see probably more taken from some areas and some other areas not touched. We still followed the idea or the premise that we wanted to do everything we could to protect the food safety situation. Our belief on this whole area is that while some may not necessarily see that as applying to all of agriculture, but I'm very concerned that we make sure that we preserve and protect the integrity and credibility of our ag products in the eyes of the consumers. I think we have a very safe product, but the consumers need to be assured that we're doing everything we can and that we're not jeopardizing their food safety issues that might arise by moving in the direction that we will be talking about. So, members, that's sort of the situation that we have it at this point, where we are. From the end of the last legislative session up until today, and I think that probably adds or fits on nicely with what Mr. Mueller did in describing sort of the background overall. If you have some questions, I'd be glad to take them regarding this at this time, or certainly Mr. Ernest, who can correct me where I was in error. Either answered all your questions or it's as clear as mud.
Commissioner, could you want to look at the ethanol payment that we removed, and can you give me some direction? I have no idea where those they are.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. With your permission and the committee's permission, on the agenda, we're moving into some of the Department of Ag reports. And I'll let Mr. Ernest do that, and I think hopefully you have a handout that that has some graph information that we've got to move to there. So, Steve, if you would please.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Ernest, Financial Management Director with the Department of Agriculture. The two colors you see on this chart refer to the regular payments and then the deficiency payments. If you remember, in the years where we paid plants 13 cents per gallon instead of the 20 cents that's in statute, we just kept track of what the difference would be and said we would pay them that when we had appropriated money freed up to do that. So you can see this year is the last year of the program for the regular payments, and there's just a little bit of green on that bar. We just have one plant still in the program that gets regular payments. That's Minnesota Energy. And then once we finish making those payments at the end of the year, we'll have the rest of that to prorate payments on the deficiencies to the plants that haven't been paid everything that we wanted to. There are 10 plants in that situation right now that we'll be paying for if our plan goes as this lays out in 10, 11, 12, and 13 until we would have all those paid off. There are three plants that have been disqualified because they're no longer producing. That's Gopher State in St. Paul, which shut down. Denco in Morris, which recently also shut down about a year ago. And then Melrose Dairy Proteins, which was a smaller producer, and they stopped producing ethanol. And then the way the statute reads is the way the appropriation law reads is that the $3 million per year that was cut, it was the intent of that law that you passed to restore that for 12 and 13. And if that were to be appropriated in those years, then the statute would allow the remaining portion of the 13 appropriation to be used for other grant programs to assist, for example, the livestock industry or other areas that we have existing programs to help out.
We'll be down here, I think.
Any questions from the members?
Yeah.
You must be doing a good job of explaining it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's with your permission, ask Quinn Cheney to come up and touch on the next gen.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Quinn Cheney, Policy Director at the Department of Agriculture. You had asked that I come and talk to you a little bit about the Next Gen Energy Board, which I know you're very familiar with as you are part of that board. The board was established by the governor in 2007 to develop recommendations and to build consensus for development of the next generation of biofuels in the state of Minnesota. There are about 20 members on that board, including legislators, state commissioners, representatives of different industry, nonprofit, and academic sectors. And the primary focus of the board is to really examine the use of the state's resources to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels and to increase our use of homegrown energy sources. The board met several times over 2009, and we covered a variety of topics such as stimulus funding, ongoing work at AURI and IRE, and updates with NextGen grantees. We also visited several advanced energy project facilities at Benson, the Chippewa Valley ethanol plant, and at University of Minnesota Morris facility. I think you all have copies of the report, so I'll just give you a really quick synopsis of what's included in this year's report. A lot of it is similar to years past. It provides a little bit of that synopsis of what our meetings, what we discussed at the meetings. It also includes an update on the Next Gen Energy grants. In 2008, the board awarded approximately $2.7 million in Next Gen Energy grants to 8 advanced energy projects across the state. These projects included such things as a feasibility to study the first commercial-scale cellulosic plant, cellulosic ethanol plant, a small-scale gasification project using turf seed biomass to produce electricity, studies on perennial energy crops, forest biomass sustainability, and a pelletizing demonstration project. These projects are all generally progressing, but because of the economic situation in the state, several of them have faced a few delays and technical and financial difficulties. The projects are required to complete their work by May 1st, 2010, by the end of the, in order for funds to be encumbered by the end of the biennium. And one of the recommendations, the legislative recommendations that the board actually had, was to give an extension for that contract period of 1 year to allow a little bit of additional time for those projects to complete their work. Really, I guess the report also includes some updates on some of the past recommendation items, and I guess I'd be happy to answer questions on those, but I don't know that I need to elaborate on them unless you have interest in any particular of those recommendations.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman, thank you for coming. And I'm just curious. I know in this committee we've had some testimony in the past about cellulosic ethanol, and I know that some of the projects that are listed in here, I was just looking through this quickly, and it lists some of those. My recollection was that there were some impediments in that, in the development of that, in terms of its economics. And do you have, or can you give us any idea of where those things are, what the status of that is? Is it?
I can tell you in particular about the project that we have. It's on page 6, the Central Minnesota Cellulosic Ethanol Partnership in Little Falls. I think what makes this particular project economically feasible, at least, I mean, they were looking into the feasibility, and I think what made this project attractive was that it was a partnership between SunOpta, which is actually a Canadian company but produces food in Minnesota, a fairly large organic and producer in Minnesota, as well as the Central Minnesota Cellulosic Ethanol Plant. So this cellulosic facility was going to build on the existing footprint of that ethanol plant and take advantage of some shared services and save some money that way. The other thing is that I believe that with their things that they're looking into as far as the byproducts of the plant are what will really help make it more economically feasible.
Anybody else? There? Yes. See, was it up north? Someplace that when it got real cold, that biodiesel did not work. What do we do with that? Do we allow them to?
Mr. Chairman, maybe if with your permission, if it's okay with you, I'll move into talking about some of the biodiesel E20 issues and then ask Jim Pearson from the Commerce Department, Assistant Commissioner there, to join up here, because some of the fuel issues obviously are under their jurisdiction as well. So if you might, or if it's okay with everyone, you hopefully have a report to the legislature on the annual report on the biodiesel, and I'll just kind of go through and summarize just a few things in terms of background on this. If you remember, of course, Minnesota has had a requirement that initially started out at a 2% biodiesel blend that was necessary for diesel fuel sold in Minnesota. As of May 1st of 2009, that increased to 5%. And the idea behind that, of course, was that we would move to 10 and 20% respectively by the years 2015, only we would revert back to the 5% blend during the cold weather months. Members may be aware that even though we moved to the 5% May of 2009, there were some issues that developed concerning some filter plugging in various places during this cold snap that we had earlier this winter. And I'll ask Commissioner Pearson to perhaps elaborate more on that area and then pick it up at this point.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Pearson, and I'm one of the deputy commissioners now at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about our experience with dealing with biodiesel issues this winter. This one was a little trickier than past years. As the committee may recall, when the B2 mandate first was implemented, there was some quality concerns, and in those issues were addressed, and we've been very successful with the B2 and the biodiesel mandate. As we got into the cold winter months this year, it became a little trickier because we didn't have widespread quality issues that were being brought to our attention, but we had rather isolated incidents that were a little harder to pinpoint. So in discussions with Commissioner Hugesson, the soybean growers, the petroleum marketers, and other stakeholders, we kind of talked through these issues and determined that at this time, until we can better answer some of these questions, the best course of action would be to suspend the B5 mandate in number one diesel fuel. So Commissioner Wilson obviously has the authority to do that on a temporary basis. He doesn't take those type of decisions lightly. So again, we communicated on that, talked to a number of the stakeholders, and did end up doing that effective the 15th of January. Since that time, we haven't had new complaints popping up, at least to our knowledge. It seems to have helped in some cases kind of buy some time as we work together as a stakeholder group to kind of pinpoint some of the issues. The other piece of this is our petroleum lab in Burnsville has develop some technology now where we're able to look at filters and analyze them to help determine causes of filter plugging and such, and that data has been helpful in trying to, again, pinpoint causes and move the discussion forward. So Just some quick comments on that, and I'd be happy to address any more questions if the committee has them.
Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question I have is, now, you were just saying, so the biodiesel requirement has been suspended as of the 15th of January? Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. What I said is that we've suspended the biodiesel mandate in number one diesel fuel. So if you're buying number two diesel fuel, that number two diesel still contains 5% biodiesel. So it's just in the number one that we have suspended the B5 mandate.
Mr. Chairman, can the department suspend it? Can the commissioner do that on his own to suspend the mandate for a couple months during the wintertime?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the current provision does allow the Commissioner of Commerce to exercise that discretion. He can only exercise that discretion on a temporary basis. So he couldn't, you know, suspend it without, you know, an end date. He can only react on a temporary basis. So the suspension is good through March 31st of 2010.
And, Mr. Chairman, this actually brings up a point. I was actually going to introduce a bill with my House member to suspend the biodiesel from December, January, February, and March because in the Brainerd School District, and I don't know, you might have heard of this complaint, the Brainerd School District, who has 70 buses, and after the winter, the Christmas break, they came back and it was extremely cold, and they're picking up little kids. And I think I'm correct in saying 35 of the 70 buses stopped. And they were scrambling trying to get these kids onto other buses and get them to school, and because all the buses gelled up. So, you know, I don't want to, and I don't like more laws and bills, but do you think that if I had you get in touch with this bus company, is there any way that we could do something, fix this problem? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I would welcome the opportunity. I actually learned of a newspaper article in your region just this last week about that news story.
Right.
We would welcome that opportunity. We had an issue last year in Bloomington that got some press. And the struggle there is when we looked into that in more detail, the Bloomington incident initially was blamed on biodiesel, but when we investigated it and looked at it, biodiesel was not the issue in that particular case. One of the challenges that we have, and we talk with our colleagues at the Department of Agriculture a lot, is getting to the details of this. It's certainly a concern because there are cases, we've been able to document some of them, where we've led it back to biodiesel. But we've had many, many cases where biodiesel was initially blamed, but in fact was not the issue in looking at it closer. Okay. So I would welcome that opportunity to discuss it and really try to help them get to the root of the problem.
Mr. Chairman, if you could just leave me your card so that you can help me kind of work through this problem so I don't have to, you know, introduce legislation to change something that probably might not even be a problem. So you can help me with that. So thanks.
Absolutely.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Pearson, I kind of on a related note here, in your experience in working with this program, how important is the mandate to this development of biodiesel or the increased use of it? If we did not have a mandate, for example, but simply made it an option for people to purchase it if they wished, what kind of an effect would that have on this program, in your opinion, in its viability or growth or sustainability? What difference would it make?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the mandate, in my opinion, is very helpful in helping an industry get off its feet. I think our experience with the ethanol industry has shown that there's a value of having some market share. And so in my opinion, I think it is an important piece. I think as a state, we've invested a lot into the biofuels industry, and I think for the most part that's been a wise investment. you know, I'd certainly welcome comments from Commissioner Hugesson on his take on it. In my view, again, it has been beneficial to help that industry get off the ground. And I think the real policy question that certainly your committee could spend time debating is, again, you know, again, the look, you know, looking at that and the timetables associated with those policies and whether they should evolve over time. But in my opinion, they've been helpful to get the industry going.
And Mr. Chairman, yes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Pearson, and maybe Commissioner Hugesson would like to comment as well. I suspect that that's the case, but I would suspect that if we passed a law requiring the purchase of any product, it would probably increase the purchasing of that product. And one of the concerns I have, and it goes back to some of the discussions we've had about ethanol, is I think that in order for these industries to be successful, they have to be economically viable. And it seems to me that by mandating the purchase of a product, it confuses the question about whether or not this is economically viable. You know, we could have a mandate to require people to purchase or use, 5% of pork products in every meal they eat. I'm sure the pork industry would love that. Or any other industry you could choose. But it would seem to me that if we want to develop these industries into something that is long-term, is sustainable, that we don't encourage a production in excess of need, or that you have to have some accurate market signals. And if you, the reason I'm questioning is because I'm wondering if we don't want to take a different approach to this instead of mandating the use of it, given some of the experiences that Senator Coring pointed out and others. Let it be there as an opportunity, and let it be sold on the basis of its economic appeal and or whatever other appeal it might have in terms of quality. Why wouldn't we want to do that instead of mandating? Just maybe your comments, or maybe Commissioner's comments.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, if I might respond. Picking up what Deputy Commissioner Pearson was saying, I certainly would agree. I think one of the things that those of us that work with diesel fuel on a regular basis realize is that diesel fuel is unique. It's a different type of fuel than gasoline, and it has much more opportunities to have problems develop, particularly as it relates to cold weather. We've seen situations change in terms of what goes into diesel fuel, be it sulfur, low sulfur, some of the additives that are put in place, and we know that there are opportunities, even as since we started this program, for things to perhaps go wrong. Mr. Pearson mentioned the Bloomington School District situation of last year, and you may remember that it received headlines, accusations that were carried far and wide about biodiesel being the cause of that problem. It was interesting that only a few buses out of the fleet had the problem, and the same supplier that supplied Bloomington supplied other school districts which were not having the problem. Upon further investigation, they found out that it had to do with the bus design, that the buses where this problem occurred had the fuel filter up far in the front of the bus so that it was more vulnerable to cold weather, and as a result, that was causing the problem. My guess is that had we not had the requirement in place and had that not been resolved and discovered, even though the Bloomington School District never did acknowledge the difference, we would have had a number of people that said, yes, biodiesel is a problem, let's get rid of it. When you look at terms of what the purpose behind this whole program was, yes, it was promoted in terms of what we could do for economic development in the rural areas. But it was also to address the whole issue of how dependent does this state, does this country remain on fossil fuels and be moving in that direction? Are there other alternatives? As it relates to the economics of this, in terms of the study that has gone into place since this has been going since 2006, the calculations that I have is really that the what it amounts to is that B2 added about a half a penny per gallon to the cost of diesel fuel, and B5 was less than 2 cents. Now, that's yes, it is a little difference, or there is a little amount of extra cost there, but is it worth that to be moving in a direction in which we are, in essence, trying to reduce our dependency on some foreign sources of oil? So I would contend that we will need to continue to work on some of these problems. As it relates to right now, as Commissioner Pearson mentioned, this is the waiver is only applying to number one. It appears that there are some unique problems to the number one diesel fuel that is not occurring in number two. So what is it about that's the difference between number one and number two? The other issue that we're having is that we need a system that we're trying to improve here, that when people have complaints, they follow a particular process in terms of getting those complaints heard. For instance, if in fact they have filter plugging, somebody needs to see those filters to determine what it is, to analyze them, what's really in that filter that's causing the plugging problem. Because it could be something as simple as moisture, which is totally possible with straight diesel fuel without any biodiesel in it whatsoever. So I think what we experienced when we moved from no biodiesel to the 2%, the first winter we had some problems. We solved those, and the next winter was not a problem. Our hope that through the effort that we're looking at this point, we can do the same thing here with the B5 situation, and by the time we get to next winter, be in a position to not have that problem occur again.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. A number of things, but first I want to comment on the price issue. If you think back to when the price of diesel fuel was $3.50, biodiesel was quite a bit cheaper. And we had trucking companies that were using a significantly higher percentage of biodiesel than the mandate requires. And that was it was an economic decision. So that can go both ways. And over time, it'll go up and it'll go down, and hopefully it either averages out or it's a benefit. I think in the long run, if you look at what petroleum costs might be, to be moving away from fossil fuels toward a renewable resource. So I think that cost can go either way. With regard to the administrative repeal that you did on the number one fuel, I think that was a perfect solution. I think it was such a perfect solution that I'm drafting a bill to make it permanent. And here's my thoughts on this. Biodiesel does tend to fall out of number one more easily than it does out of number two. And true on those buses in Bloomington, it was because they had engine and fuel tank locations so that they didn't have a warm fuel return. But that's also a problem on reefers. Reefers don't have a warm fuel return. Minnesota is a cold weather state. We need to have policies in place so that these pieces of equipment that do not have warm fuel returns work with the diesel fuel that people can buy in Minnesota, or the mandate, the biodiesel use will go away over time, because people won't put up with laying under a truck when it's 30 below changing a fuel filter. And for those of you in here that have done that, you will know that you can get quite irritated when you're doing that. So I think we need to find a solution. I think what you did was very good. You know, what it does, a couple of things when you remove the biodiesel mandate from number one. It does two things for you. You remove the fuel that the biodiesel falls out of worse, but you also reduce the amount of biodiesel you're using in total in the 1-2 blend, because a lot of times when it's really cold, they'll bend 50-50 or 60-40 or something like that. So you've got two benefits going for you at once. I think it was a good response. I think as a state we need to deal with this, because if we don't, if we go through another winter like we went through this year, and you know, people will, it's getting pretty loud where I live on this. And true, you haven't had any problems since, you know, you put that into place, but we also haven't had any cold weather since then. So, you know, let's kind of wait and see on that. But I appreciate the actions and that the commissioner or whoever took to remove that and make that action this winter. I think it was a good one. And as I said, you know, and I see lots of my friends around here, I'm giving you kind of notice that I am drafting that bill, and I'm going to ask the chair if he'll give me a hearing on it so you guys will have a chance to talk about this again.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have to follow up with a comment about my constituent calling in. You know, in the business I've been in, I've been called names before, and this is one day, I think it was about 15 below, the farmer called from the northeast part of my district and said he wanted somebody out there to help him with his hay because his tractor continued to plug up. And So once I got back from hauling the hay, which just didn't happen, but I did call, and I got a tremendous response, and I want to say that. Not only did I get somebody to listen, but actually had somebody actually come out and pick up the filters. And this guy called back and was, first of all, he was astounded that government would actually respond like that to him, but it really says a lot about what you did there and what you're doing, and I think that's a great bill there. I'd be happy to sign on with that. Obviously, some of these guys can't afford those tractors that have heaters that keep things going like that, but it definitely was an issue in my area too. But you're right, again, it hasn't been that cold since, so but that was a good response, so I appreciate that. Thanks.
Mr. Chair and members, if I may, one idea that you may consider, too, is talking with Metro Transit about their experiences. I recently was over and talked to their director of operations, and Metro Transit is obviously a large volume user of diesel fuel. They use primarily number one diesel fuel in cold weather months. And, you know, we have suspended the mandate. They continue to use 2% biodiesel blend in their fuel. Obviously, they're not required to do that at this time. They are, however, doing that. But again, if time permits, I would encourage the members to chat with Metro Transit a little bit about their experiences. And I think they offer a laboratory for future discussion, future data collection, et cetera, because obviously they have a very vested interest in making sure their buses run and have a lot of experience running biodiesel as well.
Thank you, and Deputy Commissioner. I think that's a good thought for us to be contemplating. But, you know, part of the problems with running 100% number one is the cost. And so if you could achieve the same flow point by mixing some 5% number two into a non-biodiesel number one, it would be more economical. And I do want to repeat again that there are other things in this state that burn diesel fuel besides engines on buses, and they all don't have that warm fuel return. That's a big deal. You got to think about that. This is fuel that's never being warmed. It's cold, cold, cold all the time. So it has to flow. And what's going to happen if we don't figure out a solution to this? And I'm sure people are working on it because it's important. But all the cross-country truckers, you know, they'll fuel in Wisconsin or Dakota. I mean, that's pretty obvious. It's probably happening now. But you're going to start to see people on the border sides getting their fuel from outside of Minnesota. It's going to be an economic impact that we don't want to have occur. So I think we should figure out how to fix this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add two other comments, and one of this addresses the issue, I think, of the economics. This committee may recall or be aware that there were people particularly in the southwestern part of Minnesota that were having some significant problems in terms of getting blended biodiesel, because most of their biodiesel most of their fuel supply comes out of South Dakota through a large supplier in that area. To help, and prior to when this all started, they did not have facilities in place to blend the biodiesel in with the regular diesel, and so it was done through what's called splash blending. In other words, you take a tanker of regular diesel, you pour in some biodiesel, and hopefully by the time you get to where you're going, it's splashed around enough so that it's mixed up pretty well. It doesn't always work, and so as a result, there was a little lack of consistency in terms of good product arriving on site. We tried, and with the legislature's help, we provided some money a couple years ago to encourage, incentivize somebody in the southeast or in the eastern South Dakota that supplies there to actually put some blending equipment in place with some state of Minnesota help. Nobody took us up on it. Interestingly, though, however, now a company without the help, because that money was used for other purposes since, on their own, is actually spending over $1 million and putting in a blending system that will be ready by August 2010. And I think the significance of that is that they now, at this point, see the economic benefit to having something in place and moving in that direction. So I think it, you know, there is the realization that it makes sense to be having this option or this availability, even in states that don't have the mandate, and moving in that direction. And they see the economic benefit in doing so. The other thing I would mention is that as we've worked on this issue, we've had some great cooperation from a lot of different people. Certainly, you may be aware that we have in place what's called the Biodiesel Task Force, which is a group made up of industry folks, some folks from government, but working together to try to address the issues. And one of those, there's a committee in there called the Cold Flow Committee that's working on this issue on an ongoing basis. Also, beyond that, of course, we've had, I would commend a great cooperation between Department of Commerce and Department of Ag in working on this. Ralph Groschen, whom most of you probably know, has been intimately involved with this issue right from the get-go. And so it's been a great, I think, example of how this works together. And as Senator Ingebrigtsen said, you know, when you get people that respond like this, this is what it's about, because we do want to make it work. And so I appreciate your support and your help, and it's our goal to make this become a reality on an ongoing basis.
Commissioner, you remember when we first started out with ethanol, they had trouble because they just dumped some in the barrel.
That's right.
Once they got that, so the blend or mix was right, then it just quit.
That's right.
And I think that's what will happen here. We've got to be sure we get the mix right.
Yeah.
And if it takes all the money to do that, we certainly don't want to stop biodiesel. We just don't. We're trying to be a clean state. We're trying to follow the big government's ideas, so we'll keep working on that. Mr. Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up along with your comments there, you know, part of this biodiesel issue is a low sulfur issue, and it all happened at the same time.
Right.
And if you want kind of to get some verification of that, if you get your diesel fuel out of Renshaw, which is an older refinery that got an exemption from some of the sulfur requirements, so they're a little higher sulfur fuel, you're not having the problem, even with the biodiesel in there. So, but that plant's going to go away, so our fix has to be different. But, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on when we did this that was we were going to have problems with fuel even if we hadn't had a biodiesel mandate. But because we did it at the same time, we got blamed. Everything, biodiesel got blamed for everything, even though there was going to be problems, you know, if we hadn't done that.
Any other questions? If not, Gene, you're going to stay there. We're going to grill you some more. But Ms. Pearson, thank you very much for your information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
If we have any trouble, we're going to send a sample to Commerce. And
we welcome that. Sure. We welcome that.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Let's talk about E-20 update.
Sure. Let me just quickly make some comments as it relates to E-20. I think it's something the members are aware of, but back in the 2005 legislative session, the legislature passed, the governor signed into law a provision that Minnesota would move from a 10% requirement to a 20% requirement of ethanol mix in our gasoline that is sold in the state. Pending, of course, EPA approval that this was, in fact, a okay fuel to use. Currently, it's okay in the United States to use up to 10% in an ordinary engine and, of course, up to 85% in an engine that's specifically designed for flex fuel. With the movement in this direction, the Department of Agriculture, together with some help from some of our people that put some money into this, we put some studies together that included the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State University Mankato, and some other places where some studies were done in terms of looking at what the effect would be on engines and so forth. Some of these test results were sent to the EPA for them to consider. Then you may recall that as of last summer, a group of people initiated an action to actually require or request an E15 waiver. This came from an organization called Growth Energy. That is a collaboration group of a number of different entities around the country. In December of this year, the EPA, at the end of their deadline in terms of making the yes an up or a down decision on the E15, said maybe. Instead, what they said is we still need some more tests to be completed before we can give a decision. And so, they pushed the deadline off until this next summer. I was in Washington last week and had a session with Chairman Colin Peterson from the House Ag Committee, who said that he had recently talked to EPA, and their prediction was they may have it even as soon as June of this summer in terms of if in fact they'll move in that direction. Members may be aware that if in fact E15 is approved, Minnesota would go along with that suggestion. But at this point, we have still not given up on looking at E20 and are pursuing that effort in the hopes that if nothing else, it will push EPA into making a decision that in fact will be helpful in terms of moving in that direction. I think you're aware, of course, that there's opposition to this coming from a number of sources. Typically, the automobile manufacturers, their main concern is as it relates to warranties and will they, in fact, be risk of being sued by people that get a flat tire that don't know what it is and might blame it on E20. Some of the sort of things that Chairman Vickerman referenced when we went to ethanol in the first place, the 10%. We had a lot of misinformation out there and blaming that went around on this whole issue. And so, obviously, it's understandable why folks would be looking at that as with some concern. The other concern, of course, that's going to be coming into play is would we, in fact, have a problem with some of the small engines? And as you might suspect, some of the small engines that are being developed nowadays are not quite as flexible in some of their fuel capabilities as maybe some of the small engines from before. So that issue comes into play also. There's been talk about would EPA, in fact, move in the direction of having two types of fuel. In other words, a fuel that would be used in newer automobiles, but a different mix that would be used for older automobiles and the small engines, for instance. So some of those decisions are still to be determined, and it's certainly something that we've been involved with keeping ear on and what's going on with EPA as well. So that's, in essence, sort of the story where we are really as it relates to the E20 at this point.
Well, we certainly don't want to go backwards. We've come a long way to get up to where we are. But we need to do a little adjusting, Commissioner Wiegand. We'll see that that's done.
We certainly, we're certainly moving ahead with the idea of like I say, with the E20, with the hope that if we don't get E20, we certainly would get E15, which would obviously be in a movement from where we are with the E10 that we have. And members should keep in mind that that is permissive language that would allow use up to E15 in any place. But in Minnesota, it would be a bit more prescriptive in the sense that we would move to an E15 level as opposed to the E10 where we are now.
Any other questions on this subject? If not, Commissioner, let's go into the livestock investment grants.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just briefly mention on the livestock grants for two reasons. For one thing, I should mention that they have actually been awarded in the sense that the farmers have been contacted that would qualify. The problem that we have right now is that the law, in essence, prohibits us from making this public until we have contracts signed with everyone. And that's very close to being done. But we have, and maybe Quinn has some details in terms of what we have in place, but we had, a lot of members that applied for these livestock investment grants, and the committee that went through and evaluated and determined this spent a lot of time and I think did an excellent job. And we were just about, I'd hoped we were going to be ready to be able to make that public today, but I think there's something like about five left that have not got those contracts signed. But as soon as they are, we can make that public.
Any questions?
Speechless. The commissioner said it all.
Well, thank you for that.
Thanks, Quinn.
I'm moving right along because I'm looking at the clock. Let's go into Forest Protection Reserve grants. Mr. Joe Martin, is he here?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to substitute Joe Martin with Mr. Geer Friso, who is the division director, and he will bring us up to speed in terms of what's going on with this area. Here.
And members, you should have an article in front of you to kind of follow.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Geir Friso, and I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division. And I'm going to try and fill in as best I can for Assistant Commissioner Joe Martin, who is not feeling well. Hopefully, you've got two sheets. One is a kind of a background sheet about Emerald Ash Borer that just talks a little bit about where we're at and what's transpired so far. And then the second one is more focused on my presentation this afternoon, and that is on the Forest Protection Reserve appropriation that we received last year. When we received the Forest Protection Reserve grant, there was $2 million that was appropriated to us, and of that, $1.875 million was to be delivered as grants to municipalities and organizations to address EAB. And the remaining funds was to be used for us to provide technical assistance to local units of government to respond to infestations. We decided to develop a more or less a three-pronged approach using these funds. And this was developed using a stakeholder committee that was put together last summer and then met several times and then helped us how best to approach the distribution of these funds. It was decided that the best way was to provide at least $1 million to those communities that had known infestations of Emerald Ash Borer, and at that time it was just the city of St. Paul, and then, of course, a little later came Falcon Heights. And then $875 was used for planning and preparedness, and this is intended for other communities so that they can get ready for the eventual arrival of Emerald Ash Borer or other tree pests. We prepared a request for proposals that was sent out on October 7th. We had a due date of November 20th. Then we put together a small review committee to review those grants that came in. That review committee consisted of the Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, USDA APHIS, Minnesota Forest Resource Council, and the League of Cities. We received 76 total applications, and we made a total of 18 awards. And on your handout, you'll see the breakdown of how we made the awards. Essentially, all the incident response grants, those were all funded for all the applications we received. And then, of course, we received far more applications for the planning and preparedness grants, and we did our best to provide funding for as many of those as we could. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Engelbert, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, when you talk about planning and preparedness now, $875,000, what exactly does that mean? What do the cities do once they determine that Emerald Ash Borer is in the trees in their cities?
Senator, Mr. Chair, the intent of the preparedness and planning grants was to provide some basis for the communities to prepare, and that either involved them doing outreach or an education. It may have involved them taking some proactive measures, either removing preemptively some diseased or dying ash trees, creating early detector programs. Just a number of systems that they can employ to basically get ready for the eventual arrival of Emerald Ash Borer.
Follow-up,
please. Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So it is pretty well determined that if it's in town, if there's an ash borer epidemic and creeping into our state, is it fair to say then that we should be just spending these dollars on eradicating these trees and putting up new ones? Or, I mean, are we spending a lot of money trying to find out where they are? And if we do, are we trying to prevent certain trees from getting it? I mean, is there some kind of a inoculation that we're doing? Or, I mean, give me a little idea.
Senator, Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. And unfortunately, the the history of Emerald Ash Borer in other states and other counties and communities is that, with one exception, nobody's ever been able to eradicate it once it started somewhere. But there has been success in what's called slowing the movement of it. USDA APHIS, who took an initial approach of trying to eradicate, where they actually removed millions of trees in the state of Michigan, never were able to get in front of the infestation. So that strategy has been sort of taken off the table. In St. Paul, there was an effort to remove. We had a very, very small, discrete population. We were able to age that population. It was less than 6 years old, which is very unusual. Usually, an infestation is there 10 to 15 years before you even know it's there. So there was some possibility of having some success by doing some eradication work. That was all funded by USDA. But that I want to be very clear that that is not the strategy of either the Department of Agriculture or the DNR to remove trees. The strategy really is to do what we can to contain it, to slow it down, and some of those measures involve regulatory sorts of efforts, either by preventing the artificial spread by humans through firewood, nursery stock, mills, and things like that. So we're really trying to buy time, because there's a lot of good scientists that are working on this. There's a lot of people over in Asia trying to see why ash isn't extinct over there and why it's so. So the more time we can buy, there is some biocontrol agents that are being investigated. There's three stingless wasps that look very promising. The Department of Agriculture has applied to bring those biocontrol agents into Minnesota, so that's another. That's not a silver bullet, but at least it's one one thing we can do to start addressing this and. So I hope I answered your question. No, they're not here.
Henry Kimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me, you know, I see that there's 15 grants that were awarded through this planning and preparedness grants out of the 73. Were the grants themselves that were awarded the full amount that the that was requested under the request for proposal?
Senator, Mr. Chair, there was a certain degree of negotiating that went between the committee and the applicants. We had a very formal scoring or a rating system, I should say, as to how we evaluated each of the grants. We looked at the resources that they had and their ability to how much ash component they had in the community, so how much acceptable it was, what kind of budget they had, and things like that. And then we also were looking at to try and provide as many grants as we could, and also we tried to focus on those communities that perhaps had a higher degree of susceptibility to Emerald Ash Borer. So some of the grant applicants did get the full amount. Many of them were reduced somewhat, but so.
Follow up.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then we'll probably, when we get an understanding, and I assume there will be some reports coming back from this as far as their success and what they're seeing out there. So we'll have a very good ability to understand what the next step might be after this program is done?
Yes, Senator and Mr. Chair, that's correct. Each of the grants that is part of the award is that there is a requirement that they have to provide reports back to us, and then, of course, we are required to provide quarterly reports back to the Heritage Fund as well. So I think that should give the legislature a good picture as to how well the program has worked.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to our final. Commissioner, do you have anything?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just close with this, is that certainly, as you know, the budget from the governor will arrive next week. For all of us, it's going to be a very difficult session. And I would offer to you that if there are any things we can do for
for you as a committee as a whole or individual members to answer questions from myself or any of our staff people, please, please give us a call, because we're in this together, and we need to try to get through this in a way that is respectful of our situation, financial situation, but also doing what we can to have the least negative effect for agriculture. I thank you for your great cooperation and support that we've had in the past, and look forward to continuing that this year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go into next part, confirmations. You two gentlemen, Dr. Haggerty and Horton, come up on that end and help us through this operation. Let's take up Dr. Whitten first.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, glad to see you back. My name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. And with me today is my predecessor as State Veterinarian, Dr. Tom Haggerty, who now represents the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. And I'll just give you a brief introduction about the board, and then Dr. Haggerty will speak to the members' qualifications. The Board of Animal Health is overseen by a five-member citizen board. Two of those people by law are veterinarians, and three of them are livestock producers. The two people before you for confirmation today are veterinarians, Dr. Holly Neaton and Dr. John Whitten. If you want to start with Dr. Whitten. Both of them apologize for not being able to be here today, but both of them are actively practicing, and we like that on our board, that we have people who are involved in agriculture so that they understand the issues that we're dealing with in animal health. Both of them have been board members since 2002, and not one of them, either one of them, has missed a single meeting. So they're very reliable as far as coming to the meetings, and have done a really good job. And then I would just turn it over to Dr. Haggerty to talk about their qualifications.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Haggerty. I'm here representing the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. The Veterinary Medical Association very strongly supports both of these folks for confirmation for reappointment. Dr. Whitten has been in practice 25 to 30 years. He's primarily a large animal practitioner. He's well respected by his clients. He's just does a good job. And for those of you who would understand, as we speak, he's up to his elbows in cows out in the Belgrade auction market. And I don't know who's here that gets into auction markets, but that certainly is not the most pleasant place to be on a cold day, a little warmer today. But that's what he does. He works with the clients, with the livestock producers, and he's an excellent person to be on the Board of Animal Health.
Thank you very much, members. We're going to take these separate. So Dr. Whitten's the first one. Mr. Scoy?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we recommend to the full Senate confirmation of Dr. John Whitten to the Board of Animal Health.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now we're going to I want you to look at Dr. Holly J. Neaton, and you should have a letter. Senator Dills has his regrets, feels bad he couldn't be here. But his wife and his one of his children are coming in on an airplane, and we kind of held it off. But, you know, if you flew into Minneapolis, you might be an hour late, you might be a day late. So you never know what's going to happen. So he asked me if I would send this letter around. And he would like to make that nomination himself, if that's all right with the rest of the members.
Sure.
And so, and speaking before Steve Dill, I'll move the confirmation, Dr. Neaton, to the board. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Well, members, thanks for your patience, and we'll be meeting more. When we get the budget, it comes out and see what we can do. So with that, we're adjourned.